Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit simplecast.com.
Tuned into Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service Radio.
My name is Danielle Vogel, and you're listening to Everyday Enviro on Full Service Radio, a show about the little things you can do to minimize your personal carbon footprint. This show is all about empowering you to take control of the pace of environmental progress you're making just by being a little bit more mindful about the way you eat, drink, shop, and think. This isn't hard stuff, but we'll show you just how easy it can be when you know exactly which small things really do matter. Today, I'm joined by former winemaker and current wine buyer at Glen's Garden Market, Kyle Preston. Kyle, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Thrilled to have you here, bud. Let's dive right in. You used to make wine for a living. Where were you working and what was your role?
So I was born in Oregon, right in the heart of wine country, in the Willamette Valley. And so I graduated from college, tried figuring out what I wanted to do, and ended up getting a job working at a small winery, being a harvest intern, which is just kind of the seasonal working force that goes through every year. And then right after harvest, I was hired on full time, which I then continued to do that for about 2.5 years, switching around between the small winery that I started at and then going to a large production facility there before leaving and coming out to DC.
So when I hear harvest intern, I'm assuming you're physically picking grapes. This is the job.
So actually, no. So there is migrant workers that go up and down the coast, and they're the ones who actually do most of the picking. My role was actually to intake the grapes, look at the grapes, process the grapes, and then help it go through its fermentation process. So my days were going in and standing on top of large vats and pushing wine around and like handling grapes after they'd already been picked off the vine. So that was the majority of my job.
And I know you're particularly passionate about sustainability in winemaking. So can you kind of define the parameters of debate for us? What types of things is a winemaker thinking about when they're looking to produce wine sustainably?
So it's just the fact that the best wine you can produce is through sustainable methods, because the soil is one of the most important parts of wine production. So if you're putting a lot of fertilizer or chemical additives into the soil, that's going to come through in the wine. You're going to actually taste those chemicals in there. And so the process is to take care of the soil as best as possible. So it's reusing natural fertilizers. We take, after you press off the grapes, you then use those grape skins as like the fertilizer again. So these are like some of those kind of processes that you'd go through. Using beneficial pest control, which is just having different levels of grass and having different grasses in between each vine, so that you
instead of pesticides,
yeah, there's just like natural pesticides that are plants, and so they.
Can you be more specific? Because that's really interesting.
So that's one part of the field that I'm not fully into, because there is the production winemaking side, and then there's the vineyard side, and I spent most of my time on kind of the production side. But one of the processes that I did get to see is you'd have rows that were, you know, grass was going up to your waist, and then you'd have other other rows where it was just flat on the ground.
And they're trying to attract the bugs to mm-hmm. the level of the grass.
That's yeah, and then they'll plant certain plants that go into it. And when you had Andrew Stover on, he talked about biodynamics, and that's one of the, you know, that's one of the processes in biodynamic farming.
So when you were making wine, what were the things you felt you were really getting right from a sustainability perspective, as specific as you can be about what you guys were doing on your property?
So one of the things that we tried really, really hard to do was to use as little additives as possible into our wine. And my winemaker, he actually was very frustrated because the owner of the winery, he really, really wanted to use some like chemical, or not chemicals, but he wanted to use industrial yeast and enzymes. And that was like a really frustrating thing for my winemaker to have to deal with, because he came from Burgundy where they don't use stuff like that. They kind of do, they use less industrial processes. But in the vineyard, we actually, it was a salmon safe, live certified, which is a certification within the Pacific Northwest where you're using sustainable practices. We dry farming, so we didn't have to use irrigation and things like that. But in the actual winemaking process, we were not, you know, fully on the, like, using the best practices, which was a really frustrating thing for my head winemaker.
So actually that sort of leads me to my next question, which is, if somebody was looking to transition their operation towards sustainability, what are the easiest sets of things that they can maybe start with, kind of the low hanging fruit, as mm-hmm. it were?
So there's actually been a revolution in the kind of the wine industry, which is this term natural wine. It kind of is this umbrella thing. But what it actually comes down to is low intervention. That's the real term that we should probably be using, which is you pick the grapes, you let them start fermenting by themselves with just indigenous yeast that is on the grapes. You don't put any additives in it. You don't filter it. And then you just put it in a bottle as itself. And so that process is just, you know, you're not actually using any sort of industrial chemicals or industrial yeast or anything like that. You know, that's kind of the easiest way to get into sustainable wine practices.
So when you're talking about indigenous yeast, this is kind of what we're starting to see pop up on the beer menus. Mm-hmm. It's called wild yeast generally. Mm-hmm. It's naturally occurring in the field itself.
Yeah, so there's yeast that's on the grape skins. And once you take it off the vine and put it in a bin, it'll just start to ferment by itself. That's just a natural process. What the industry has done is they picked yeast strains that are a little more aggressive, and so they kind of beat out what the indigenous yeast that are already there. They'll take over and create their own environment. So winemakers have stopped adding those, and they just allowed the wine to kind of produce itself.
So am I hearing that grapes are literally grown to become wine? They come complete with their own fermenting yeast?
Yeah, they do.
Occurring naturally?
Yeah.
Thanks for that layup. Awesome. So, okay, so those are some of the easier things for a winemaker to aspire to. What are the harder things to achieve from a sustainability perspective? So what are the industry leaders doing that other folks may be struggling to replicate?
So I think one of the things that the industry is kind of having a struggle with is this natural wine movement is kind of a difficult subject for old school winemakers and new school winemakers.
Because they can't control the result as closely. Yeah. It's a little bit of a funk fest.
Yeah, so once you do it that way, you're not really sure exactly what you're going to get. And what happens sometimes is you get off flavors that winemakers have been trained that's not supposed to be in your wine. And so there's been kind of there's still a battle, but we're seeing more and more people kind of switching over and thinking about it in a different way. And you can make wine like high level wine without having to use additives. You just have to be a really good winemaker to do that. So that's, you know, that's kind of one of the difficulties. Also, in the natural wine scheme, sometimes bad winemakers make a bad wine and they say, oh, it's natural because it
it's
has...
It's an inside joke. I meant this.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So it's one of those kind of, it's one of those battles that's happening right now. I mean, like it's, we're at kind of ground zero right now with everything going on.
If I could back you up for just one second, mm-hmm. when you say that the natural wines sometimes have off flavors, mm-hmm. what does that term mean?
So there's a thing called volatile acid, VA, and it kind of smells and tastes a little bit like nail polish remover. Mm, okay. And that is something that winemakers have to fight to not have in their wine, and sometimes that'll show up. There's also a yeast strain called Brettanomyces, or it's also known as Brett. Yeah, it's used a lot in beer, but it has for a long time been... thought about as kind of an off flavor in wine. Sometimes it's in there, sometimes it's put in on purpose, but most of the time it's just such an aggressive yeast strain that it gives you some like weird off flavors, kind of like...
Is it a little sour maybe?
Band-Aid.
Band-Aid.
Yeah.
Delicious.
Yeah, Band-Aid is one of the flavor profiles.
And I know sometimes there's a little bit of secondary fermentation as well. So you'll get a little bit of effervescence that may not be totally intentional.
Yeah. So that, you know, that's just kind of one of the things that'll happen. Sometimes it is intentional though. There's not a new form, but it's called Petrulant Natural.
Petnat.
And that is, they are purposefully allowing it to ferment in the bottle. They get it almost to the point where it's done fermenting, and then they'll put it in the bottle and it'll naturally create the CO2 in there.
And the idea is we're just looking for a little bit of fizz.
Yeah, basically.
Okay, cool. Who doesn't love that?
Yeah.
So as you and I know well, you are no longer a winemaker. Now you are buying wine for Glen's Garden Market.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're sourcing our wines, what are you seeking out in terms of growing practices? And specifically, what words are you looking to see on a bottle or hear from a wine distributor that convey a winemaker's commitment to sustainability?
So the first thing is to hear it has to be sustainable. So there are regulatory terms: sustainable, organic, biodynamic. That's what I'm looking for. I can't go outside of sustainable. Now that is kind of a broad term, but it's very hard to make really good wine if you are not using sustainable practices.
Yeah, as my math teacher used to say, junk in, junk out.
Right? Yeah. So that, you know, high level wine has to come from sustainable practices. That's just the way that it is.
So when somebody is shopping for wine on our shelves or frankly any other, if they care about sustainability, they should be looking for words like organic or biodynamic, or even sustainable on the label itself. Are there any other words that would trigger them to understand that the winemaker was sort of practicing their value set?
So no sulfites added.
Okay.
Sulfites is kind of a term that people know about. People think that it gives you headaches, but sulfites just naturally occur in wine. So no sulfites added mean that they are intentionally trying to make it under that category of natural wine. They're not trying to put any additives into it. And that goes all the way back down to the vineyard. Once you're trying to make natural wine, you have gone through all of the practices, including the vineyard practices.
So in your opinion, which winemakers are really getting it right around here from an environmental perspective?
So around here is actually a difficult place, but up in New York State, they are...
Still a state of the Chesapeake Bay watershed,
yes. So,
local for our purposes.
Yeah, up in New York State, Redtail Ridge, they are working very, very hard to use sustainable practices. Ravines... down here in Virginia, it is a very, very difficult growing region. You have to deal with frost. You have to deal with humidity. You have to deal with
incredible amounts of rain.
Yeah,
of
incredible
late.
Amounts of rain, hurricanes. I mean, it is a very difficult region. So down here, it's a little more difficult to use full sustainable practices. But Bro Vineyards is working very hard to do that. Barbersville is working very hard to do that as well. Everyone's trying to get as close to sustainable, organic, biodynamic as you can. But in the region of, you know, in Virginia, it's a lot more difficult to do that just because of the growing state.
So we heard Ravines, we heard Redtail Ridge, Bro, and Barbersville. Any favorite bottles from those guys we should seek out?
So Ravines is making a dry Riesling on a high level. Redtail Ridge, their winemaker actually was just nominated for a James Beard Award. Anything that's coming from Redtail Ridge, they're just working on a very high level. Barbersville, their Cabernet Sauvignon is delicious.
I love their Nebbiolo.
Their Nebbiolo is great. And then Bro, they make, it's called the Equation. And what the Equation is they take multiple years, multiple vintages, and they blend it together as like the Equation of this is what Bro Vineyard tastes like.
Oh, that's so interesting. Yeah. So it's sort of a vertical tasting in a single bottle.
Yeah, basically. Yeah.
That's neat. Let's pivot for a sec to non-local wines. Mm-hmm. And if you'll allow me to weave a bit of a narrative here for a moment. So in the early days, we only sold local wine at Glen's. In fact, we only sold local everything at Glen's. But we came to the realization in 2017 that we were actively making it inconvenient to shop at our store because we couldn't offer the neighborhood what they were looking for in certain categories. Produce was one of them. They wanted things like lemons and bananas and avocados. Wine was certainly another. And as great as our local wines are, and they are great, sometimes you just want a proper Malbec or a Tempranillo, and those grapes just don't thrive in our ecosystem. So we started to look beyond the states of the Chesapeake Bay watershed for key items we needed to round out our product mix so that folks could do their whole shop at our store. And to be clear, that was a tough decision for us. But in the end, we recognized that we were limiting our own change agency by driving our neighbors into our competitive stores. Stores that generally had less rigorous sourcing standards than we do from all manner of perspectives. So we decided to bring in some non-local items in key categories, and we plant 5,000 trees every single year to offset the transportation emissions incurred in getting those items to our stores. Wine was a key expansion category. Enter Kyle Preston. I gave you a challenge, Kyle. I asked you to build a stellar wine program that highlights what we're doing well locally and also incorporates non-local wines that represent our commitment to sustainability. Tell us about the non-local wines you brought in from places around the country or even around the world that are really leading the way from an environmental perspective.
So we still have about 60% of the wines on our shelf. They are coming from the Chesapeake Bay watershed. But the 40% is coming from around the world. And so I have a couple. I have one from Washington, Oregon, and California. It's just one of each. And the one that I really want to talk about is Stolpmann Vineyards and a wine that I know that you love.
Which Quadria.
Is, yeah, the La Quadria. Stolpmann is really working not only on sustainable environmental practices, but also sustainable employment practices. And when you're working on sustainable employment practices, people get a little bit more invested into what they're doing. So the La Quadria, what they do is they give their vineyard staff a experimental vineyard plot where they just get to work and learn how to actually work the land as opposed to just being a
farmhand.
Yeah, just being a farmhand. They're trying to actually show them how to grow properly. And then each year they make a wine from that vineyard plot and the money goes back to the actual vineyard workers. But what that's doing is you're creating an employment force that can go and use the same environmental practices and go to a different vineyard and say, hey, you guys are using the wrong environmental practices. This is what we should be doing. We've also been able to bring in some small family wines from France and Italy and Austria. We've been able to identify places that are small family-run wineries that care about the environment, that care about where they're at because that's their home, that's where they were born and raised, that's the land, and they know that if they treat the land improperly, they're going to make bad wine. So I've been able to identify a couple a couple places around the world, some a little larger, some a little smaller, but they all are working really, really hard on taking care of the earth because they know that they're going to create great wine that people are going to love if they take care of the earth first.
So if you're looking to come check out the Quadrilla, which of course is one of my favorite wines we've got, it doesn't have any words on the label. It's just sort of a tribal drawing of a hawk.
Yeah.
Is it a hawk?
Yeah, yeah, it is a hawk.
I have a dream that Kyle will soon get a tattoo of that.
Sometime.
But just back to what you were just saying, folks may not realize this, but depending on where you live in America, it can actually be less carbon intensive to get wine from Europe than it is to get wine from California.
Mm-hmm.
Can you speak on that for a second?
So wine coming from Europe comes on a boat. They put it in large shipping containers. They put it on a large boat that's able to transport, you know, hundreds and hundreds of these shipping containers. When we're getting it from across the country, we're putting it on a semi and actually driving it across the country. So there are blackout times during the year where companies over on the West Coast can't ship over to the East Coast because it's either too hot. Yeah, it's either too hot or it's too cold. But what you're doing is you're driving across, and it's just one, you know, it's just one shipping container. So the amount that you can put on a large boat and bring it across to port, you just can't do that with the, you know, the semi transportation that we have. It's also a little bit closer to get to Europe than it is to get to just a little bit.
So I was reading recently that the dividing line is really the Mississippi River. If you live east of the Mississippi, then you can more carbon efficiently get wine from Europe.
Yeah. And we, you know, we live on that side. So
sure
it's,
do.
Yeah. So it's a lot easier. We have just kind of like the right, we have the right processes already put in place. That's, you know, it's been going on for hundreds of years where we've been shipping back and forth between Europe and the United States. It hasn't been as long, because the car wasn't created, you know, until the early 1900s. So we've been able to figure out how to do that on an efficient scale.
I'm so pleased to know that I can drink my Italian Barbarescas with impunity.
Yeah. And, you know, Italy has been a driving force in organic and sustainable wines. They've been doing it since the early 70s. Some of the first, you know, wineries come from Italy who have gotten certifications over there.
I knew there was something I liked about those guys. So we're talking with Kyle Preston about sustainable winemaking and perhaps more directly related to my daily routine, wine shopping. We're going to take a short break, and when we get back, we'll dive into price transparency in wine. Back in a sec. Welcome back. This is Everyday Enviro, a show about the small things you can do to reduce your personal carbon footprint. I'm Danielle Vogel, founder of Glen's Garden Market, and I'm joined today by Kyle Preston, winemaker and wine buyer extraordinaire. We've been talking about sustainable practices in winemaking and wine buying. Now we'll dive into wine pricing. Kyle, who among us doesn't yield occasionally to the sweet, sweet call of a bargain basement bottle? But generally, I'm looking to spend between $15 and $20 on a decent weeknight drinker. Can you walk us through the math that goes into that final shelf price?
So shelf pricing is a very, very difficult subject because it kind of is up in the air, right? Wineries and winemakers, they come up with their own pricing. There's also kind of a stock market for wine. So you know, some of the most expensive wineries, you know, you're talking about $1,000 for a bottle. But when you're looking for that $15 to $20 range, the reason that you're spending that amount of money is because you're actually paying for people to do their job. So when I was making wine in Oregon, some of our bottles would range up to $65. The reason for that is we had to pay for 40 migrant workers to come and pick our grapes. We had to pay for the, you know, 10 people who were working 7 days a week to make sure that the wine was being made properly. You know, wine pricing comes down to labor costs, because when you aren't putting in industrial fertilizer, when you're not spending money on having to, you know, like take care of the land, because it just does it itself naturally, what you're spending your money on is you're actually spending your money on paying for the people to make your wine. The other part about it is that for a red wine, it takes minimum 6 months before you can even think about putting it in a bottle, for it to go. It takes about 2 weeks for it to go through its fermentation process. Then it has to settle out for a while, and then you can put it into a bottle. But in reality, you're probably talking about 2 years before that bottle is being released to the public. So that's 2 years of not making any money at the winery. You're spending $1,000 on a barrel. You're spending all of your money on your labor, and you just have to sit on it for 2 years. So there's some of that cost into it. Also, there is what's called the three-tiered system. So we work in the wine industry. You have a producer, you then have a distributor, and then you have a buyer, and that's the system. So it has to go through those. It has to legally go through those systems for you to purchase wine. So the winery is making a small wholesale cost. Then the distributor is making their money on top of that, and then the buyer is making their money on top of that. So there's three levels of actually having to pay for that bottle of wine to even get onto the shelf.
And the distribution, I think, is a hangover from Prohibition times.
Yes, it is. So, one way that you can help, especially with small wineries that don't distribute very well, is a lot of them have their they can do direct-to-consumer purchasing. So that's
tasting rooms, wine clubs.
Yeah. So going out there, you're actually going to be helping those smaller wineries be able to continue to produce, because they're taking in, you know, the majority of the money. They're not having to sell it at a discounted price to the distributor, and then the distributor selling it to the next person. So that's, you know, that's kind of where some of the pricing comes into play. But when we're talking about a $65 bottle of wine, it's because it's been handmade, hand done, hand picked. Everything is, you know, hands on, and it takes a long time before it can even hit the market. So that's where the pricing comes into play.
And then it's handled by a distributor and then a retailer, mm-hmm. and the retailer has to slap their margin on top mm-hmm. of that. Yeah. So let's use round numbers for simplicity. So our best selling bottle of wine at Glen's is a Malbec. It's $9.99. Mm-hmm. Let's round it to $10 for this conversation. Mm-hmm. So at the $10 price point, who gets what share of the money?
So at the $10 price point, we are probably making 33%. The distributor is probably making 33 to 50%, and then the
gets the last third. So it's basically mm-hmm. a third, a third, and a third. So
basically
$10 on the shelf, the winemaker gets $3.33.
Yeah.
That's not very much.
It's not very much. And wine is an expensive process to have to go through.
So there's a tension here, right? Because we want to buy affordable, delicious wine, but now we know we're shorting the farmers and the winemakers when we do it. Mm-hmm. What do we do?
So, you know, you actually still just continue to buy that wine, because those wineries, the wines that you are buying for $10, they probably have a higher level wine where people are, they are working hands-on and they are paying for people. The reason that some of those wines can cost the price that they are is because they don't go through hand harvesting. They actually use machines to do that. But then when we get into some of the higher level wines, or higher priced wines, there are people who are actually doing that. So those lower priced wines are usually just the driving force to bring in money, because you know that's $3, but you're selling, you know, 50 to 100 pallets of wine.
So there's like a down market brand and then mm-hmm. an up market brand.
Yeah.
Cool. That's interesting. Mm-hmm. Although I'm sure it's not going to deter $10 wine sales.
Oh, no, much. No.
You're telling us buy more expensive wine on occasion.
On occasion. Yeah. If you can afford it, it helps out a lot of it really helps out a lot of people. So when I was born, my town was a podunk redneck, you know, middle of nowhere kind of town. And then as I started to get older and the wine industry started to become more prominent and people started putting in more wineries, I saw my town actually change from being kind of really poor into having a little bit more money. And now the downtown area of my hometown has some really, really awesome restaurants. It has, you know, it's completely changed the economy of my hometown.
What's the name of your town?
It's called McMinnville.
McMinnville.
Yeah.
The town that wine built.
Yes. So, you know, the same thing happened in Napa. Napa is now has a lot of money, but it was a small town and it just kind of revolutionized their economy. Wine can change economies because there is a lot of money and there's a lot of jobs that are part of the industry. It takes a lot of hands to make wine. Mm-hmm. And so you have to hire a bunch of people. Buying those wines, especially coming from other countries where they have very, very low labor costs, you know, you're providing jobs for a lot of people. Wine is one of those industries where there's a lot of jobs that are a part of it.
Do your part. Buy more wine.
Yes.
So let's bring it back to the environment for a second and switch gears, if you'll allow mm-hmm. me another ridiculous pun. I know you're a cyclist. Mm-hmm. You either bike or you walk to work every day, mm-hmm. which is a great choice from an environmental perspective. Mm-hmm. So thank you. Are there any other things you're doing in your life to reduce your personal carbon footprint?
You know, I try to purchase as much stuff that comes from, you know, the sustainable, organic. You know, I buy a lot of products at Glenn's because I care about that. I've always cared about buying local and being, you know, caring about where the products come from because, again, you know, it comes back down to the money aspect of it. I think that if we can buy products from as close as possible from small producers, we are going to the economy is going to be better, and we're going to take care of the earth. So I try to purchase as much stuff from, you know, small producers and people that I care about. I like going to farmers markets, although I generally have to work during the time that farmers markets are happening.
We'll have that discussion off air,
yeah.
Shall we?
But I like, you know, I like going to farmers markets. I like knowing the people. When I'm looking at purchasing wine, you know, for Glenn's, I like sitting down with the winemaker if they're around and talking with them because, like, that, you know, I know what they're doing to the earth, and, you know, they care about that. And so that, you know, that's kind of a lot of the stuff that I.
So shop your values and know mm-hmm. your farmer.
Mm-hmm. Try awesome. To.
Thank you so much for being here today, Kyle. It was so much fun to learn a bit about your journey and to get your take on conscientious wine buying.
I had a lot of fun. Thank you for having me.
But before we end our time together, let's take a moment to reflect on why climate change is a problem worth even attempting to address at the personal level. It's huge and complex, and at times it seems well beyond our control. But it's not. This is your moment of motivation. Since 1901, the planet's surface has warmed by between 0.7 and 0.9 degrees Celsius per century. But the rate of warming has nearly doubled since 1975, and global temperatures haven't been cooler than the 20th century average since 1976. Since 1990, the warming influence of all major greenhouse gases has increased by 40%. And for those who still somehow believe this is all an inevitable natural phenomenon, the annual rate of increase in atmospheric carbon dioxide over the past 60 years is about 100 times faster than previous natural increases, such as those that occurred at the end of the last ice age, which was about 17,000 years ago. Humans are dramatically exacerbating climate change, and it's on us to work together to address it. But until our Congress activates, it's on us personally to do what we can to make good environmental choices. I'm not asking you to become a climate nut like me. I'm just asking you to think twice before you choose single-use plastic or buy a piece of clothing you really don't need. The little stuff adds up, and it matters. All right, Kyle, catch me as I jump off my soapbox. I'm coming down. But seriously, thank you so much for being here, buddy. I really learned a ton. And thank you for listening to Everyday Enviro on Full Service Radio. If you have an idea for a show or a guest, or you have a question about how you can reduce your personal carbon footprint, hit me up by email. I'm at glensmarket@gmail.com. And in any event, I'll catch you again next week on Everyday Enviro. Talk then. Bye, friends.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter @FullServiceRDO, Instagram and Facebook @FullServiceRadio. Thanks for listening.